Hello, and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I'll give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Shamika, who's here to talk about her life, her education, what she's been up to lately, and some cool things that she's been getting into on the internet and helping people with so many different things. So I'm excited to listen to her story and get to know her. So Shamika, why don't you go ahead, say hello, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey folks, the rumors are true. I am Shamika. I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas, the oldest of four kids, and ended up going to school in California, went to New York City for AmeriCorps, and now am in Boulder, Colorado, pursuing a doctoral degree. So I'm sure we'll get into all the good details, but that's me in a nutshell. I'm currently in the Information Science Department at CU Boulder, and I am studying technology ethics and social justice issues, and I'm also the founder of the Tech Chaplaincy Institute.
Awesome. It sounds like you've been on a bit of a whirlwind and have got lots going on. So why don't we start a little bit with your education, what you got into, how you got into this doctoral program and all of that.
Sure. So I'm actually a first generation college student. I was, when I was in math camp back in, you know, when I was in junior high and high school, I went to this math camp at Texas State University. And the camp math camp director, Dr. Max Warschauer, encouraged me to apply to Harvard and Stanford and all these schools. And I was going to go to Howard Payne University in the middle of nowhere, Texas. And he thought, well, that's probably a fine school, but there's other places that you could go that I think that you'd be great. And if you want to stay in Texas, you could apply to Rice. But there's more out there. And I was thinking, okay, sure, I'll apply to these great schools, but you got to write a letter of recommendation for me, which he did. So I was accepted into Stanford University, and I was very grateful for that blessing, and ended up attending there for my undergraduate degree. And while I was there, I had a leave of absence of 4 years and was living in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, briefly for about 2 years of that time. And when I was finally able to return and finish my degree, I ended up studying African and African American studies after trying economics, after trying English and management science and engineering, just all these different degrees. I ended up gravitating to this department. Well, it's a department now. They've just announced, instead of just a degree program, Stanford is going to turn it into a department, which I think is super exciting. So when I was in my final semester, I was in a design class, and one of the assignments was to go to a job fair and just walk around and be open to things. And I had already applied to an AmeriCorps position in Washington State. And it wasn't Seattle, it was something like Sacoma, I think. And so I thought that's where I was going to go. So I wasn't really thinking much would come of this job fair assignment. But I ended up striking up a conversation with someone from Reading Partners, which is an organization that started in California with these two older women who were going to elementary schools and just helping students who were struggling with their reading learn how to read better. And they started in California and were branching out. They were starting a new cohort in New York City. And the person who I striked up a conversation with asked if I'd be interested in applying. I'd never been to New York City. I don't know anyone in New York City. I don't have family there. But I was like, oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to consider it. I'd be happy to apply. So yeah, I was just making a nice conversation. But they followed up with an email. And so I put in an application. And then ended up getting offered a job in New York City after graduation with Reading Partners. So I served a year with AmeriCorps in Queens Village, New York, at PS 33 Edward Funk Elementary. I was the site coordinator there. on the very top floor, which was really, there were no elevators, so it was nothing but stairs all the time. And as part of the first cohort, I was responsible for establishing the program in the school, getting buy-in from parents, from teachers, and of course from students. And so it was a challenging year, but it was also so rewarding to have my site be one of the larger sites out of the five, because we had one in all of the five boroughs. And we had a book raising program where we would encourage people to come and donate books to our site. And it was something that everyone in Reading Partners across all of their sites were doing in the fall. And we just kept it going through the rest of the year. And we had over 5,000 books donated by the end of the year. It was insane, incredible. It was so exciting. That was one of the most proud things I'd ever done up to that point in my life. Next to graduating from college after being on leave for so long. So when I finished AmeriCorps, I decided to stay in New York City and got a job at Baked by Melissa's, which is a bite-sized cupcake company there. And I got to work as a customer happiness associate, which was exciting. I mean, Baked by Melissa's is a really interesting company. It was fairly new and it was growing. So when I got there, they were still opening new sites. They were doing new things with their cupcakes and all kinds of fun things were happening. So it was interesting to be a part of that as it was unfolding. But at the same time that I was working there, I was attending services at St. Lydia's Dinner Church and Parables, which are both emergent churches. One is Lutheran, the other one is Lutheran and Episcopalian. And I was having a conversation with one of the pastors, the pastor of St. Lydia's Dinner Church, Emily Scott. She was the pastor at the time. And it was one of these getting to know the new folks conversations. And she was asking me about my faith journey. And I gave her the story of what had happened to me in my home church. So back in San Antonio, when I was a kid in junior high, I started going to Missionary Baptist Church. And I was very involved in the church. I was leading the youth choir. I was helping with homework. I was attending youth Bible studies. Whenever there was something going on for the youth, I was there. And sometime around my junior year in college, I decided that I wanted to pursue becoming a Christian author and speaker. And I thought maybe I can go to Bible college. Maybe this is something that I could really pursue. And I decided to tell my pastor that Sunday. And he had preached a sermon on dream killers and Jacob and the coat of many colors and the dreams he was telling. And I misread all of those signs. I thought this was the perfect time to tell him about my dream. And I clearly hadn't been listening to the sermon, because when I went into his office that Sunday and I explained to him this whole idea, this dream that I had, he proceeded to kill my dream. He was like, churches are a dog-eat-dog world. There's no market for what you want to do in San Antonio, and you can't make one. And I was just sitting there with my little church notebook taking notes. Like, it was, I don't even know. And then it was only after that conversation when I got home and I thought, why would God tell me this wonderful dream and not tell my pastor? Like, God's supposed to talk to all of us, you know, this, and like, it blew my mind a little bit. So for 6 months, I didn't go to services formally. I would wake up on Sundays and I would sing and pray and journal to myself. And then I started going to non-denominational churches before moving at the time. So this was the story that I told Emily Scott, the pastor. And she was like, I am so sorry that happened to you. He was wrong, first of all. I'm sorry that happened, but is there any reason why you can't pursue that dream now? And I thought, well, I guess not. I hadn't really thought about it in several years. I wouldn't even know where to start. And so she said, well, I think seminary is a great place to discern things. And we had been talking about how I was thinking about what my next steps were going to be, sort of in life in general. After serving with AmeriCorps, I really fell in love with service and wanted to continue serving people and commit my life to serving people. I just wasn't sure what group of people and how I would serve them. And I also knew back when I was in the seventh grade and I first learned about what a PhD was that I wanted to get one. I just wasn't sure of exactly what that PhD would be about. So when she recommended I go to seminary and explore some of these questions, she and my other church very graciously allowed me to, they paid for me to audit a class at Union Theological Seminary there in the city of New York. And so it was the spring semester, so the second half of the year. I ended up taking the one class that could fit on my day off, which was Mondays. And it was the second half of a class on American Christian liberalism. So I had missed the whole first half of this class. But I took the second half, and on the very first day of that class, it was with Professor Dr. Gary Dorian. And on the first day of that class, everyone was introducing themselves and then picking a theologian that they would later in the semester write a paper on. And I looked at the lists of theologians and I didn't recognize any of them except for Martin Luther King Jr. So I was like, well, I guess that's the person I'm going to pick. So I introduced myself. I said Martin Luther King Jr. And then like a couple students later, someone says, and I wanted to do Martin Luther King Jr. And the professor was like, well, it's been picked. I was like, oh, no. I'm just auditing this class. She can totally, I'll pick someone else. Professor stood up for me and was like, nope, you pick Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That's the one you're going to take. They're going to have to pick someone else. And I was like, oh, well, gosh darn. And eventually I decided to apply to be a student at Union. And at first I thought, well, I don't know. I might not get in. And then I got in. I was like, well, I don't know. I need housing. And then I got housing. And I, well, you know, I don't know. I'm going to need some financial aid. I got financial aid. And so everything just kept falling into place. And eventually I couldn't say no. So that's how I got into seminary. And my first semester in seminary was when I was just being very helpful to people. People started asking me for help with their setting up their email, setting up their new computer. And the word got around that I could help people with their technology. So more and more people started asking for help. And so eventually I went to the IT department and said, hey guys, there's a lot of students who need help with their tech stuff. So could you all do like drop-in hours or something? And they did the best thing they could have did, which was to say, no, but you're doing such a great job. Why don't we just support you in continuing to do what you're doing? So I ended up working through the IT department in my second semester at Union. And that was when I developed tech chaplaincy. I had remembered these conversations I was having with people who were saying, who I'd helped with their technology. And they were saying how different it was, because usually when they ask for help with technology, the person who helps them, they make them feel a little silly or stupid or like they did something wrong, or they'll fix the issue and not tell them how they fixed it or what it was that was even wrong in the first place or whatnot. And it was just a lot different when I was helping folks. And I was explaining this to one of the adjunct professors at Union, who's also an alumni of Stanford and a pastor as well. And so when I was explaining to him how I was helping people differently, he said, well, it sounds like you're a chaplain to people. You're practicing this ministry of presence with folks, and you're ushering them through these difficult moments with dignity and grace. And that's essentially what a chaplain does. And so that's where the concept got its name of chaplaincy, of tech chaplaincy. And throughout the rest of my time at Union, I served students, eventually faculty and staff, and then eventually faith communities outside of Union. I served folks as a tech chaplain. And the other thing that came out of my time at Union was, since I was so interested in technology and spirituality and technology and faith communities, for my senior thesis or my thesis for my Master of Divinity degree, I wrote about techno-womanism. So when I was taking my first semester, I was taking systematic theology with the late Dr. James Cone, who's the father of Black liberation theology. He told us something I'll never forget, which was that we all have a theology. We all have a theology to contribute to the world in a way of seeing the divine and our relationship to it. So I took that and I combined it with womanism, which is a liberation theology based off of Alice Walker's definition of a womanist, which is from her 1983 book, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, A Womanist Prose, in which she defines womanism in four parts. The first part of the definition is a womanist is a Black feminist or feminist of color. The second part of the definition, it's sort of poetic, so there's all these pieces to it. But the second part of the definition that I like is that a womanist is committed to the survival and wholeness of the entire people, male and female. The third part of the definition, a womanist loves. She loves music and dance and roundness and the spirit and the folk and loves herself and all these things regardless. And then the fourth part of the definition is actually the one that most folks quote, which is womanist is to feminist as purple is to lavender. So this concept of womanism was taken up by Black women theologians, and it was developed into a theology, an ethical framework, and it has had at least three waves since the 80s, leading into the 2000s, the early 2000s. And I wanted to take that womanist ethical framework and apply it to social justice issues that were occurring in and around the digital space and around technology. So when I was in seminary, so 2013 to 2017, when I was starting to write my thesis, it was 2014. So this was around the time that the Black Lives Matter movement was really getting going. And it was also the time of Gamergate. And being at Union, which is a social justice oriented institution, there were a lot of my peers who were involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, but not a lot of them knew about Gamergate. Or I would talk to people about the issues that were happening with Google tagging Black people as apes or gorillas or any of these things that were happening. And I thought, there's a connection here. There's something that needs to be said. Like there's an ethic that is missing from technology conversations that I think the hundreds of years of work that the church or that Christianity or that other faith communities have contributed to the concept of what does it mean to be good? What does it mean to do good? What does it mean to be human? And how does that all relate to technology? Like I was trying to have these conversations with people, 7-8 years ago. And not a lot of folks, I didn't get a lot of traction, if you will. And so I wrote my thesis and I did a thesis project in which I wrote a paper and I also did a series of YouTube videos, which I embedded into the paper. And that was the introduction of techno-womanism, which was the second thing that came out of seminary, with the first being tech chaplaincy. And when I finished my degree, my Master of Divinity degree, I took some time to do an online coding boot camp where I furthered my coding skills. I had picked up some coding skills in high school when I made my first website on the fly for math camp. I just sort of taught myself HTML over the course of a couple of days, basic HTML. And then decided to work in the tech industry for a couple of years before I pursued a PhD, where I would continue to study technology ethics and social justice issues. So after this online coding bootcamp, I found it very difficult to find a junior developer position in New York. So I ended up relying on my tech chaplaincy experience, and I was able to parlay that into roles providing tech support to charter schools in New York, which is what I ended up doing for about a year and a half leading up to when I applied to doctoral programs, because I decided, well, since I wasn't able to get the junior developer position I was thinking of, there's no reason to wait to go into a doctoral degree. And the longer I wait, the more difficult it is going to be to get letters of recommendation from my faculty, the faculty who I've worked with, because as time goes on, it'll be harder for them to remember me and this sort of thing. So I decided to just go ahead and apply to a doctoral program in the midst of my time being an IT support specialist at a charter school in New York. And when I applied, I wasn't sure initially where I would apply, because I wanted to study technology ethics, social justice issues, but it didn't seem like that fit in a computer science department. And then I thought, well, if I study this in another department, I'd have to bring the technology in, or I'd have to plant my flag, so to speak, in a particular discipline and then bring other disciplines with me. And that didn't seem very viable. So I had a conversation with a friend of mine who I met at the Digital Labor Conference in New York in 2014, Dr. Nathan Schneider. He and I are both interested in technology and spirituality, and he wrote a book on platform cooperativism. Really cool person. But when I met him at this digital labor conference, he was writing articles for different venues and whatnot, and then we kept in touch. So he moved from New York to Colorado to become an associate professor at CU Boulder. So when I told him I was struggling to figure out where to apply for doctoral programs, he said, well, here at CU Boulder, we have an iSchool. I think you should apply there. And I was like, what's an iSchool? So he explained information science was this thing, and I should look into it. And I did. And I discovered that information science was a really viable place for my scholarship, because it is interdisciplinary. It is an opportunity to think critically about the technology we create and use. And so I ended up applying to CU Boulder as well as several other programs, including Oxford, which has an internet institute. And I did not get accepted into any program except for one, which was the one that my friend Nathan Schneider told me about. So had I not had that conversation, had we not emailed, like all of these things, right? Just like with Dr. Max Warschauer in the math camp, I do believe people are put in my path, and I'm so grateful for that. So I was invited to be a prospective student at the open house here at CU Boulder, and I was so grateful to come to visit Boulder and got to stay at the Boulderado Hotel, which, very clever, Boulderado in Colorado, the name there, and got to meet faculty and students and connect with folks before getting accepted. So that was the long-winded story of my education leading up to today. I'm in my second year now in the doctoral program.
I think it's great. I loved hearing the different phases and how things kind of fell in your lap and how you didn't know what to do. And it kind of just seems like the path has worked out really well. You've gotten experiences from a lot of different facets to then be able to pull into what you're doing now and what you are currently working on. So now that you're in this PhD program, what are you doing with the Tech Chaplaincy Institute? Are you still doing that a lot. And of course, like with the pandemic and everything being more online, I kind of would think that last year was a bit of a busy time.
Yes. So the Tech Chaplaincy Institute, I launched officially on Juneteenth of last summer, which happens to be my grandmother's birthday. And so I started it in the summer between my first and second year. And I decided going into my doctoral degree that I wanted to have a side hustle. I wanted to start this Tech Chaplaincy Institute, but I wasn't sure of when. And I thought, well, I'll wait till the summer. I'll have time in the summer and whatnot. And then as the pandemic hit in the spring, I was like, oh, I wish I had started this sooner. My goodness, there's so much need, and folks are really, folks could really use a tech chaplain. So by the time I started things in the summer, I was so grateful to be able to journey alongside a number of folks. And we focus specifically on faith-based communities who are open and affirming, social justice-oriented, progressive spaces, as well as mission-driven organizations. So that could be a nonprofit, but that could also be a for-profit organization who has a great mission. But essentially, when I was in seminary, I noticed that the people who had really holistic, life-giving theology didn't always have the best relationship to technology. And the faith communities that did have really cool, interesting, cutting-edge technology, they weren't always open and affirming. They weren't always social justice oriented. So I wanted to help those spaces who did have that open and affirming social justice oriented perspective with their faith, who were maybe struggling with their technology pieces. So that was the initial impetus for the Tech Chaplaincy Institute. And since June, we've journeyed alongside over 50 different faith communities, individuals, organizations. We helped the Evolving Faith Conference Spiritual Care Team, which is a large Christian conference, as they went online, and helped them figure out how to do what they did offline, in the digital space. So how do you spiritually care for people virtually, and what does that look like? And we've also partnered with groups of churches. So there's dioceses or synods or presbyteries or regions or conferences or these different ways that churches and faith communities organize themselves, and we do that as well. And essentially, we focused on helping people with their website, either updating it or fixing it or creating it, or social media strategy or software support. So figuring out how to incorporate G Suite or Google for Work, as they're now called, into your organization, figuring out church management software such as Planning Center or Breeze, or figuring out Zoom. Lots of people had to figure that out on the fly, but there's still folks who want to know, you know, how can we use this tool better, more secure, etc. And then also helping people with figuring out how to do what they're doing now in a hybrid situation, because what I have had conversations with people about now is there are faith communities who maybe didn't consider technology being playing a large role in what they do. And now that it's been thrust upon them, so to speak, they're now seeing that, wow, there's a lot that can be done with this. And so the questions are now thinking through theologically, liturgically, how can we incorporate technology into the way that we engage our faith, the way that we build our relationships with each other and our community and our God and our divine. And those are all conversations that we help facilitate with people and help guide people through those questions and those conversations. And as a tech chaplain, we really pride ourselves on being able to address fear and anxiety around technology and replace those things with empowerment. So we teach and train folks on how to use their technology. We're not a tech support like the Geek Squad will come in and set up your internet or this kind of thing, where instead we're going to teach you how to do it and teach your staff how to do what you're looking to do so that you have those skills yourself and you can take those into the future. So the Tech Chaplaincy Institute is something that I am hoping will be in a place where when I graduate with my degree, I'm still able to serve folks and it'll be sustainable and profitable and allow me to still have that venue with which to help people. And I've had conversations where people are so grateful at the end of their session where they go in and they're not sure what to do or how to do something. And they leave that conversation, which is my favorite part. They leave the conversation realizing that they can do something, or they didn't realize how well they knew something, or they didn't realize what could be done, or they just feel better about their relationship to technology. And that's really, that keeps me going. That really helps me know that what we're offering is something that people really appreciate.
Yeah. And it sounds like you have such a great mission. I know a couple years ago when I was at a church, they had all these signs for shut-ins and they were literally recording their services, and they had a PowerPoint and they had video and they had all this stuff. And I was like, wow, that's really cool that they're doing that. Like, I've never seen something like that. And then when everything shut down, I immediately thought to them and I was like, they have a plan. They'll transition really well. Whereas, you know, one of my friends was talking about what their church was doing and they're like, they're trying to figure everything out. So I think the services that you're offering can help lots of great people and great missions. And I like that you're very much focusing it in on those socially justice-minded people and having that right audience. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing in this PhD program? What are you learning and what are your goals? You know, you're going to get that PhD that you've been thinking of for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm in my second of 5 years. So the Information Science Department at CU Boulder is fairly new. They just graduated their first doctoral students last academic year. So the idea of being 4 to 5 years for the length of the program is something of a guesstimate, but they're hoping that that's going to be true. And in your first 2.5 or so years, you're taking courses, you are working on your first and second research projects, and that's exactly what I'm doing. I've been working for the past year or so on a project looking at Black Twitter and comparing it to the Negro Motorist Green Book, and looking at how they are similar, how they're different, and looking at the conversations that are happening on Black Twitter and the ways that people who engage with Black Twitter, what they think about researchers, what they think about outsiders, what they think about just different concepts, different things. And they're the ACM Digital Library, which is the... I think it's the collection of different conferences that have to do with computer-human interaction and information science and computer science and all of these similar conversations. They don't have not one dedicated article to Black Twitter, but they have plenty of articles about Twitter in general or online communities or any of these sorts of things. So I'm hoping that the paper that we write does get accepted. We're writing to the CSCW, which is Computer Supported Cooperative Work, I believe. That's the conference and publication that we're hoping to get this paper accepted into. So that project, once it's wrapped, I will be looking next at a research project where I want to talk to Black people who create technologies specifically for other Black people and get to know what kinds of things go into creating technology specifically for Black communities. What are the values? What are the goals? What are the challenges of that work? And essentially be able to distill from those conversations, likely interviews, be able to distill what are the takeaways and insights from those experiences and from those technologies that can be used in other ways, in other platforms, and in other spaces. And one of the things that I'm working through right now is my research identity. So I need a what color is your research parachute kind of thing, where I can figure out exactly who I am as a researcher, what my research questions are, and this sort of thing. And one of the things that I'm curious about is how Black people create and appropriate technologies to survive and thrive. And I'm also curious about, as I mentioned before, technology and spirituality or technology and faith communities. I'm really interested in Afrofuturism and Black science fiction and perhaps how that can be incorporated into participatory design work. So that's also something I'd be interested in doing later on down the line. And as I approach my, there's three major milestones coming up in my program, the first of which is a prelim exam, the second of which is a comprehensive exam or a dissertation proposal, and then there's the dissertation defense. And so those are all going to be happening over the next 3 years. So I have some time to really think about and figure out what kind of work do I want to do in the world? How do I want to contribute to the conversations that are happening with scholars like Dr. Ruha Benjamin, Dr. Safiya Noble, and so many others who are entering this space around race and technology. And I would love to have something that helps move the needle forward, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you're doing some great research and asking a lot of the right questions to, you know, you see a gap and you want to figure out why is there that gap and what can we do to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an audio only podcast, so people will not be able to see your screen or my screen, but behind you, you have a sign that says Black Minds Matter. So I'm curious if you would be willing to share the purpose of that sign and kind of what it means.
Absolutely. So this is a sign that I made for a protest that happened back in 2014, alongside Union Theological Seminary students and Columbia students. We were protesting the way that Columbia University treats students of color and faculty of color. And we were advocating for better treatment, better support from the institution, and to have them address the issues that students and faculty were facing. So I put this sign together. On the other side of it, it's actually a Ferguson sign that I repurposed. So when I went on that march, we marched around Columbia University's campus and we were chanting different things. One of the chants I remember us doing was in response to Eric Garner, where someone would say, "I can't breathe," and then we would count. And we would count, I think it was 11 times we would do that, and then we would start over. And that was the number of times that he said that before he passed, before he was killed. And so when we finished our march, I remember I did it right in the middle of a class that I was taking at Columbia. Even though I was a Union Theological Seminary student, we still had access to those classes. So I was taking a sociology class about social media, and I got there just in time for the last 5 minutes of class, and my throat was sore from chanting. I still had my sign, and my professor, when he saw me come in, because you couldn't help but hear us, our voices were ricocheting off of the buildings, so if you were on campus, you heard us, you knew we were there. And the professor, when he saw me come into the classroom, he just put up his fist and he was like, I got you. And I was so appreciative of that moment. And the professor, I forget his name, but he's a sociologist who did his dissertation work studying gangs in Chicago, I believe. And he was someone who ended up being on my committee as a professor who was grading my thesis work, essentially. And so I really appreciated him being so understanding of me participating in this march and really being supportive.
Yeah, that's really great that you missed class and then had that support right there. I'm sure that really meant a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, his name was Sudhir Venkatesh.
Now, I don't think I've got any other questions before I start to wrap things up. Is there anything else you would like to share with the listeners?
Well, I didn't get a chance to talk much about my personal life, but I will say that on the winter solstice of 2020, December 21st, I did get married to the love of my life. So I am now Shamika Klassen, and I met my now husband over 10 years ago when I was living in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. We met at a grocery store in the middle of the night. He was the cashier and I was just checking out. I was getting some lunch for my night shift as a certified nursing assistant. And it was one of those special moments I will never forget. So I just wanted to share that with folks.
That's super sweet. And I mean, I you know, we focused a little bit more on education and important stuff like that, but the personal moments are also great too. So I love that little meeting, that little story. So with all of my guests, before I do my outro, I like to ask a random question that's typically not with anything that we've talked about. My question's going to be a little bit out there for you, so we'll see if it sticks. My question is what is your take on aliens?
You know, when I was a kid, Alien Autopsy came out on Fox, and I was hook, line, and sinker. I also thought, for longer than I care to admit, that we did not go to the moon, but that's another story, because of Fox. But I will say about aliens, I believe that statistically, it is possible with all of the corners of the universe that life exists somewhere else and that intelligent life has developed somewhere else. UFOs have been confirmed by the government. They've released the documents. That just means unidentified flying objects. That doesn't mean aliens, but it is a step in the right direction. And I think that I leave room for it. And if it happens, I will not be surprised. I'll just be like, oh yeah, yeah, of course.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. I will be leaving links to Shamika's Tech Chaplaincy Institute website along with a link to her PhD program, more information about that as well. And of course, all of the podcast links are in the description as usual. So Facebook, Instagram, Patreon, and we're on LinkedIn as well. And if you would like to guest on the podcast email is there. It is introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. So I would love to hear from you. And thank you, Shamika, so much for spending time with me today. And to my listeners for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Bye, y'all.